from the cells. Hickman and Adyafi remain steadfast in the conclusion that it was impossible that these men died by suicide in their cells. This was murder, Hickman said, adding, I think about it every single day. Adyafi explains that he and his brothers, fellow detainees, always did everything in their power to prevent a suicide from occurring. I can't say exactly what happened, he told me. Something, they were killed. Additional mysterious deaths followed over the years. In all, 9 detainees have died at the prison. Allegations of cover-ups emerged, but the deaths remained shrouded in secrecy. With few exceptions, no one really cared. Even the preposterous story put forward about these suicides failed to shock the public into condemning the ongoing travesty of justice that Guantanamo represents. The narrative that these men did something terrible and deserved to be imprisoned for it defines the very nature of the post-9/11 response. It doesn't matter that the original accusations against many of them were flimsy and easily disapproved. Due process and presumption of innocence, the defining values of the American ideal of justice, would be forever denied them. The vague language of enemy combatants and terrorists dehumanized men across the West Asia region to the point at which the U.S. was able to commit profound abuses of human rights with impunity and public support. Americans were convinced in the years after 9/11 that the men locked in Guantanamo or being killed in drone strikes abroad or tortured in CIA black sites were sworn enemies of the U.S. regime who deserved to die before they could cause more senseless death. And so the atrocities followed, committed over multiple administrations on a global battlefield where U.S. forces played judge, jury, and executioner against terrorists and enemy combatants who also happened to be farmers, taxi drivers, mothers, children, producing an unbearable human toll exposed only by painstaking reporting. Renewing calls for justice for the men who died at Guantanamo feels like an exercise in futility, yet those permanently maimed by Guantanamo refuse to stop seeking justice. I would like to see the people that were behind it held responsible, but it's never gonna happen, Hickman says, adding, I think it was murder, and it should never go away. It should be investigated until it's solved. The deceit and lies and cover-ups of the worst moments in post-9/11 history have created an endless stage of hypocrisy for all the world to see. Ahmad Eradici, a Moroccan chef, wrongly imprisoned for years at Guantanamo, said that the longer the injustice at the detention camp continues, the more damage it does to the reputation and legacy of American culture, American principles, and American morals. He called for former Guantanamo detainees to be allowed to finally testify before Congress and for victims of CIA torture to be allowed to take the American government to court.
The Real Royals.
Part 1.
The British royal family, an institution instantaneously recognizable throughout the world. Positioning itself as both the face and heart of Britain, the monarchy purports to perform a dual role. Promote British interests on the global stage, and at the same time sustain and justify its own institutional relevance.
Oi!
The royal family sets out to perform these apparently complementary roles by projecting a carefully crafted and jealously guarded image of propriety, diligence, and unflinching pursuit of duty. To that end, the British monarchy goes to extraordinary lengths to discourage, distract, and disrupt any real scrutiny of its true role and performance. But keeping up appearances is not always an easy task. The recent controversy surrounding the estrangement of Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle is just the latest of a long line of scandals engulfing the royal family in the past 3 decades. Much to the Queen's dismay, the so-called Harry and Meghan saga has depicted the royal family in a poor light. The most serious charge relating to allegations of racism, initially directed at Meghan Markle, whose mother is African-American, and then more ominously towards her baby. As Meghan Markle recounted to Oprah Winfrey in the now famous interview in March 2021, an anonymous senior member of the royal family was concerned how brown her baby was going to be. There was widespread speculation that the anonymous racist at the top of the royal family was none other than the new deceased Duke of Edinburgh, husband to Queen Elizabeth for 74 years. The notorious escapades of Princess Diana, wherein the estranged wife of Prince Charles engaged in multiple extramarital affairs, was arguably the first time in modern times that the carefully managed moral reputation of the British royal family was shattered in front of a global audience. Similar to Meghan Markle, the late Princess Diana informed the world of her pain and anguish through a hard-hitting interview with BBC Panorama in November 1995. The description that Diana provided of the royal family nearly 3 decades ago is eerily similar to its recent depiction by Meghan Markle. Both accounts present the British monarchy as a cold, distant, and unfeeling organisation, which not only demands total obedience from its members, but by extension, it goes to extreme lengths to discredit those who are perceived to have broken the rules. Strategic heavy lift capability. Both Diana and Meghan are perceived to have broken the rules, and very quickly the two women were ostracised and cast as outsiders. Diana would ultimately pay with her life for daring to criticise and expose royals. And as for Meghan Markle, it remains to be seen what fate awaits her. For if Mohammed Al-Fayed, the billionaire father of Princess Diana's late lover, Dodi Fayed, is to be believed, Princess Diana, alongside her lover Dodi, was murdered by the British Secret Service MI6 on the instructions of the monarchy. The allegations could be dismissed as a conspiracy theory, was the only one making them, but he is not. Even former MI6 officers have made the same allegations, and in the process, supplying credible details to support their incendiary claims. It is now widely suspected that Henry Paul, the deputy head of secretary at Ritz Hotel in Paris, who was driving Diana and her lover Dodi on that fateful late August night, was a long-standing MI6 agent. If indeed the Queen had given a nod and a wink to her Secret Service to deal decisively with the increasingly troublesome Diana, then there was a much bigger message conveyed by that suspected murder. You cross the British monarchy at your own peril.
Your Majesty's guard is ready to march off, ma'am.
To gauge the extent the Queen will go to protect her interests, the best place to start is the great name change of 1917, which enabled the British monarchy to conceal its German roots. by all credible accounts, the great majority of the British people are unaware of the distant roots of the monarchy. Since the accession of Queen Elizabeth II to the throne in 1952, the British establishment has tried hard to depict the monarchy as a quintessentially British institution. However, the reality is very different. The name change from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor was effected by King George V at the height of World War I, at a time when the British public were understandably alienated by German names. From this cynical name change, it can be deducted that there is nothing uniquely British about the royal family. Therefore, Tony Blair's assertion that the Queen and her entourage represent continuity in British public life is yet another cynical deception perpetrated against the British people. The Queen may project an image of quintessential Britishness, but it is doubtful that deep down she still doesn't feel a fondness for Germany, not necessarily contemporary liberal Germany, but the Germany of old, specifically the Teutonic way of life of the 19th century. Let's not forget that the longest reigning British monarch, Queen Victoria, who ruled for nearly 64 years, died in the arms of a German emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II. Who, astonishingly enough, was her grandson on the Isle of Wight in 1901.
As a child, I never imagined that one day a man would walk on the moon.
The royal family reportedly continues to celebrate Christmas the German way by opening presents after afternoon tea on Christmas Eve, which falls on December 24th. By contrast, the British people open presents on Christmas morning, December 25th, typically before breakfast. Although these quirks might be dismissed on the grounds of sentimentalism and nostalgia, but the story gets much more sinister. Britain's shortest reigning monarch, Edward VIII, whose 11th-month reign in 1936 coincided with the policy of appeasement towards Nazi Germany, is a case in point. Edward was well known for his pro-German political sympathies. "Every drop of blood in my veins is German." Edward VIII is reported to have boasted to pro-German activist Diana Mitford, arguably the most accomplished of the notorious Mitford sisters and the then wife of British fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley. Germany's ambassador to the court of St. James's, the prominent Nazi Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was German foreign minister throughout World War II, even called Edward V half-German on account of the king's effusive pro-German sympathies, if not his mastery of the German language and cultural mores. Indeed, Edward VIII was no ordinary appeaser, insofar as he actively supported the German cause in the 1930s. His support for Nazi Germany started very early, no later than the foundation of the Nazi regime in 1933, when as Prince Edward he encouraged the young princesses, Margaret and Elizabeth, to give Nazi salutes while on a visit to Germany. It is equally noteworthy that, like his brother before him, King George VI was an admirer of Hitler and the Nazis, and an active supporter of the policy of appeasement, which historians blame for the outbreak of war in Europe in September 1939. It has often been said that had Edward VIII been an ordinary citizen, he would most likely have been charged with his treason and swiftly executed following the conclusion of World War II in Europe in May 1945. Another element of Britishness is, without doubt, the Treason Act of 1351, one of the oldest pieces of legislation still on the statute books. At the same time, this ancient law is emblematic of the royal family's disregard, if not contempt, for the body of ancient English laws which it claims to uphold. One quirk of this ancient law is that it constitutes high treason to violate the wife of the king's eldest son or in contemporary terms, the Queen's son, which in this case happens to be Prince Charles. Based on this law, multiple prosecutions could have been launched against the various men, notably Army Major James Hewitt, who entered into consensual romantic and sexual liaisons with the late Princess Diana, the wife to heir apparent to the throne, Prince Charles. Despite her widespread popular appeal, Princess Diana was known to be promiscuous and had affairs with multiple men, including James Gilby, the heir to a large gin fortune, Etonian art dealer Oliver Hoare, rugby player Will Carling, the Pakistani heart and lung surgeon Hasnat Khan. There were even rumours she had an affair with John Kennedy Jr., the late son of John F. Kennedy. Incidentally, until 1814, the penalty for high treason was death by hanging, drawing and quartering, thereafter reduced to death by hanging. Ignoring the Treason Act indicates that the British monarchy is more than willing and able to engage in legal manoeuvrings, even to the extent of seriously compromising the rich tapestry of ancient and modern laws and norms, which underpin the UK's unwritten constitution, in order to stay afloat. The Princess Diana saga, which only concluded with her untimely death in 1997, is just one example amongst many. Prince Andrew is yet another and much more contemporaneous example. The errant prince is wanted in the US for questioning in relation to the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, which saw multiple underage girls abused by the deceased American financier. Prince Andrew, or until very recently the Duke of York to give him his formal royal title, was a close confidant of the American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who chose to commit suicide in a lonely prison cell instead of facing the music for his shocking crimes. The Duke of York abused his royal privilege for more than 2 years to avoid accountability in a formal setting, and all the while the Queen said nothing about the whole sordid affair, before she finally caved in to public pressure and stripped her son of all titles and charities. But then again, Prince Andrew has form when it comes to corruption and scandal. Dubbed Air Miles Andy on account of his extravagant travelling arrangements, it is reported that in 2003 alone, he racked up £325,000 flying around the world, including using a helicopter to fly to Oxford and misusing RAF planes to fly to Scotland to play golf. To make matters worse, his former wife, the scandal-prone Sarah Ferguson, caused deep embarrassment to the Queen when she was exposed by a News of the World sting operation in 2010, in which she promised to arrange access to Prince Andrew, who was then the UK's special trade envoy, in exchange for £500,000 in cash. The royal family has struggled with issues of nationality and political allegiance. It could be said they have an easier relationship with religion and religious identity. Easier in the sense that the Act of Settlement 1701, whose cardinal aim was to ensure a Protestant succession to the English throne, places a prohibition on Catholics ascending to the crown as kings or queens. Astonishingly, this act is still religiously adhered to, and the British monarch is presented as defender of the faith, as in Protestantism. But the offence and discrimination this act inflicts is no longer limited to Roman Catholics, as the demographic and cultural diversity of Britain has hugely expanded since the early 1950s. Modern Britain is home to millions of people of non-Christian backgrounds, notably Muslims and Hindus. Since the early 1980s, the British government, in tandem with large business organisations and civil society writ large, has gone out of its way to place diversity at the pivot of its domestic policies. This attitude has given rise to an idiosyncratic British concept of multiculturalism, which purports to promote equality of opportunity amongst the UK's diverse demographic groups. But is the Queen's status of defender of the faith consistent with this policy? More broadly, the religious issue, although highly symbolic, is just one example among many where the Queen is seriously out of step with developments in British society. To properly integrate this disparity in world values in British society, the best place to start is the political realm. The UK likes to project itself as the world's oldest democracy, taking special pride in its parliamentary roots.
Hundreds of respondents took part in the Stoke-on-Trent.
Supporters of the British establishment never tire of reminding the world that their core parliament, the House of Commons, is the oldest such institution in the world. This is a myth, of course, as there are many ancient parliaments out there, such as the Swedish Parliament or the Riksdag, some of which predate the House of Commons by decades and even centuries. Pedantic disputes aside, the modern House of Commons is generally recognised as a democratic institution, as demonstrated by the rigorous selection and election processes, which take place before someone from whichever political party takes up his or her place in Parliament. And yet these very same people have to not only swear an oath of allegiance to an unelected monarch, but worse still, throughout their tenure, they are forced to demonstrate defence to the royal family, often against their own best judgment. At least for the past 120 years, there have been professed Republicans who are against the monarchy establishment in the House of Commons and, lesser still, in the House of Lords. There are not many of them, but the fact they are there and are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen introduces a degree of hypocrisy into the British political process.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, her heirs and successors according to law.
Worse still, the fact that MPs are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen is the strongest indicator that all legal and constitutional means for removing the Queen and the royal family have been closed off. Short of a revolution, the British people simply cannot overthrow their unelected rulers. The Queen, of course, does not reciprocate in kind, insofar as she does not swear an oath to uphold parliamentary democracy, let alone serving the people. But the real picture is much worse than that, inasmuch as every major British institution, from the military down to the prison system, is trapped in this unreciprocated oath of allegiance. On account of this comprehensive hegemony, how can stalwarts of the British establishment claim the Queen is bereft of political power and yet keep a straight face at the same time? At this juncture, it is necessary to gauge an accurate picture of the extent of the Queen's powers. Just how powerful is she, and to what extent can the monarchy affect the tide of British destiny? The simple answer, of course, is that the Queen and her heirs have tremendous powers which affect the daily lives of Britons and, to a lesser extent, the citizens of those countries where the Queen is still nominally head of state, notably Canada, Australia and New Zealand. In keeping with British tradition, where subtlety and discretion are prized characteristics, the monarchy exercises political power through ancient and seemingly innocuous-sounding institutions. One such institution is the Privy Council, officially a body comprised of senior politicians whose job is to advise the Queen on the exercise of the royal prerogative. For one thing, the Privy Council remains a secretive arm of the state, with a set of traditions and rituals that come close to Masonic theatrics. And at the centre of its official business is the Queen herself, who is physically present every time the Council meets to utter the words approved or referred in order to direct or influence policy proposals. In short, the Privy Council constitutes the principal vehicle by which the royal prerogative is enforced. In the words of the former Liberal Democrat MP turned establishment critic, Norman Baker, the Privy Council is effectively a one-person law-making, decision-taking machine. The royal prerogative, whose spirit and functions are embodied in the Privy Council, has multiple layers, with each layer in turn producing multiple, if not countless, powers and privileges. For instance, the prerogative of perfection is a function which confers personal immunity on the sovereign from ever being sued in the courts. The Queen is quite literally above the law. If the Privy Council represents the hard edge of the Queen's far-reaching powers, then the honours system constitutes the soft core of her barely concealed, all-encompassing influence. Going back all the way to 1348, with the establishment of the Order of Chivalry against the backdrop of the Black Death Plague, Britain's honours system enables the Queen to maintain the country's social and economic hierarchy. By doling out honours, indirectly by way of the government, the Queen confers favours and recognition to those whom she approves of. Officially designed to distinguish between different degrees of achievement and service, the honours system actually performs the opposite by conferring recognition on those the establishment, and by extension the Queen, seeks to promote and elevate. But the honours system, like every feature of British public life, is vulnerable to deep corruption. In the Cash for Honours scandal of 2006 to 2007, for instance, honours and peerages for the House of Lords were offered to individuals who had made large financial donations to the then-ruling Labour Party. The Queen clearly knew about the corruption, but for reasons of political expediency, or some other consideration, she chose to turn a blind eye to it. In one of the latest controversial examples, the Queen directly bestowed knighthood to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, regarded by many as a war criminal for his role in waging the 2003 Iraq War. The story of the real royals does not stop there.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
in the limelight.
What is happening in Palestine is not removed from what is happening in the US. There is increased gun violence. The consequences of the gun lobby and weapons manufacturers in the US have destructive and deeply unjust consequences all over the world, including in the murder of Shirin Abu Aghele. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Yosra Bitar, writer. This article is published under the heading Big Players in Finance Profited from Gun Used to Kill Shirin Abu Aghele. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. On May 11, 2022, Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghele was killed. It is widely believed that she was intentionally targeted by the Zionist regime armed forces. A CNN investigation concluded that video evidence and witness testimony suggest that Abu Aghele was shot dead in a targeted attack by Israeli forces while doing her job and wearing a clearly marked press vest and helmet. Last week, the Palestinian Attorney General concluded in a new report that the bullet that killed Abu Aghele was a 5.56mm round fired from a Roger Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle. The Connecticut-based company Sturm, Roger & Company Incorporation produces this Roger Mini. Roger was originally founded in 1949 to manufacture firearms for the commercial sporting market. Today, it is one of the largest publicly traded gun companies in the U.S. A network of investors, banks, and directors are the real power behind Roger, providing the company financing and governing as it profits from harm like that committed against Shirin. These profiteers behind Roger include major corporate actors like BlackRock and Vanguard, as well as board members tied to a host of harmful industries and causes. According to Roger's most recent proxy statement, two single asset managers, BlackRock and Vanguard, own more than a quarter of the company. BlackRock, the world's number one asset manager, owns the largest chunk with 15.9% or 2,792,671 shares, an unusually large stake even for BlackRock to have in a company. BlackRock and its CEO Larry Fink have made gestures in recent years around the social responsibility of investors. Fink's 2018 letter to CEOs, for example, stated that society is demanding that company, both public and private, serve a social purpose, and that to prosper over time, every company must not only deliver financial performance, but also show how it makes a positive contribution to society. Nevertheless, BlackRock remains the largest shareholder of the top three publicly traded gun companies. BlackRock seems to know this is a problem. Indeed, it has made statements distancing itself from the gun industry's harm. For example, a BlackRock spokesman recently said, as paraphrased by the New York Times, that BlackRock's holdings of Roger did not mean the company had taken an active investment position on guns. But these statements and positions are an invasion on BlackRock's part. As Roger's top shareholder, BlackRock is in a stronger position than anyone else to hold the company to account. However, it describes the nature of its involvement. The truth is that it has a major stake in Roger that it benefits from and is one of the few actors with the power to do something. The same goes with Vanguard, Sturm's Roger's second largest owner. Vanguard Group, the world's second largest asset manager, owns 10.7% of the company. That is about 1,888,300 shares. Vanguard has also come under heavy scrutiny for its investments in harmful industries. As we reported earlier this year with Action Center on Race and the Economy, Vanguard oversees nearly $6 billion in investments in high-risk sectors in the study funds that perpetuate environmental and racial injustices. Renaissance Technologies, Sturm Rogers' third largest owner, is a hedge fund based in New York State. Renaissance owns 5.9% of the company, about 1,030,575 shares, according to Sturm Rogers' 2022 proxy statement. This investment has increased dramatically since 2018, when report said on Renaissance Technologies' 1.2% stake in the company. James Simons, the CEO of Renaissance Technologies, is a major donor to the Democratic Party. According to Open Secret, Simons and his wife, Merlin, gave more than $24.5 million to super PACs supporting Democrats in 2020 federal elections, including $11 million to the Senate Majority PAC, $5 million to the House Majority PAC, $4 million to Priorities USA Action, $3 million to Unite the Country, $1.5 million to Strategic Victory Fund, and $10,000 to Just the Truth PAC. James and Merlin Simons also made maximum donations for a combined $139,400 to New York Governor Katie Hochul, who has made gun control a main campaign issue in her electoral campaign in the wake of the white supremacist attack in Buffalo. It's not just the asset managers and hedge funds that own Roger that prop the company up. Banks do this as well. For example, Regions Bank, the biggest bank in Alabama, provides a $40 million line of credit for Roger. Wells Fargo also bans done business with Roger, issuing the gun company a $40 million line of credit in 2018. A 2018 Bloomberg article called Wells Fargo the go-to bank for gun makers and the NRA, and it stated that the bank had helped two of the biggest U.S. firearm and ammunition companies access $431.1 million in loans and bonds since December 2012. Roger has a board of directors whose members govern the company and personally profit from it. These directors own hundreds of thousands of dollars and even millions in Roger stock. Moreover, some of these directors who benefit from weapon sales are also tied to harmful companies and reactionary causes that contribute to upholding gun violence in the U.S. and oppressive regimes worldwide. Fossil fuel and extractive industries. Ronald Whitaker served as the president and CEO of HYCO, a company that produces technology that eases fracking and fossil fuel extraction. Philip Whitman served as the chief finance officer and senior vice president of the Terex Corporation, a construction equipment giant with focuses that include energy and mining. Whitman and his wife have also donated to the National Right to Life Political Action Committee, the PAC, one of the oldest organizations in the U.S. Whitman took $208,630 in 2021 as a Roger director, and his 27,829 company shares are worth $1,848,958 million as of June 6, 2022. Additionally, Michael O. Pfeiffer held leadership positions in Mueller Industries, which has committed a number of environmental violations, including being one of the companies held responsible for soil contamination in Chicago. White supremacist ideology. Sandra Sandy Foreman helped William Shockley promote white supremacist eugenics theories while at Stanford University, though she has claimed that she does not remember working with him. White supremacist ideas like Shockley's have contributed to a growing far-right threat and escalating violent attacks on black people, immigrants, Muslims, and others. Foreman earned $190,864 from Sturm Roger in 2021 and owns 13,570 shares of the company, which are worth $901,590 as of June 6, 2022. And private prisons. Although he has a step down, it is worth mentioning Michael J. Cobby. While chairman of Rogers' board, he refused to engage in dialogue with shareholders concerned about gun safety in the past. In 2021, J. Cobby earned $198,090 from Sturm Roger and took in 6,359 shares of company stock worth $422,491 as of June 6, 2022. He was also on the board of CoreCivic for 16 years. CoreCivic is the largest private prison company in the U.S., owning and managing private prisons and detention centers across the U.S. CoreCivic and the private prison industry have come under widespread scrutiny, with many banks fleeing from them to avoid the bad publicity of the association. Numerous scandals, from mishandling COVID-19 outbreaks to forcing detainees to work for little pay while being threatened and deprived of basic rights, have occurred in its facilities.
Çömen. Yani...
Bazaar.
Gathering around food is an ingrained part of almost all cultures worldwide. It's hard to imagine going to a wedding ceremony without its endgame dinner. Many celebratory and ceremonial events include food. Eating is not only necessary for survival, but also it is seen as a pastime and a way to get out with friends and family. For many, it is also a source of income. And the food industry is driven by the tastes of various customers, making it one of the most profitable industries in the world.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week, we venture through Iran's food industry while shining the spotlight on baking equipment. We will explore the industry's national and international markets to get an idea of some of its significant activities. Also, we will touch on subjects like agriculture to understand its role in national food security. So, let's get started.
To familiarise ourselves with the types of equipment needed in the food industry, we visited Borac Industrial Company. With 40 years of experience in manufacturing, this company specialises in the mass production of machinery and equipment needed to bake bread. Some of these machines are pretty large and can weigh up to 7,000 kilograms, taking up large spaces in a room. This company has expansive production facilities with high output to manufacture such massive machines. Most of the raw materials for production at this company are purchased from inside the country. For example, the manufacturer buys steel sheets, wires, and plastic components from other manufacturing companies. It then shapes these raw items for the desired machine components in its production halls. This company employs dozens of people directly. It also offers training to its staff to keep up with the various new production methods and produce new machines. In the food industry, competition is driven by high-quality food that comes in a diverse range of attractive products. Lucky us customers. The machinery used to make these items also need to be flawless to produce items that satisfy us, the customers. Consequently, companies expand their product lists to match their customers' varied tastes while introducing new items. So machines are essential to the ecosystem of the food industry. As bakery businesses must adhere to food safety standards, the machines and equipment used to produce food products must match these standards too. Aside from food safety standards, these machines must be dependable with quality assurance. If a machine fails, a baker may not be able to sell their goods, which reduces profits. For this reason, this company also follows manufacturing standards set by the National Bureau of Standards and International Standards for Production. Due to the high yield of this manufacturer, it not only supplies bread-making machines to domestic customers, but also exports its items. In addition to exporting its products to neighboring regions, it sends its items to countries in Europe, among other destinations. This manufacturer employs industrial engineers and designers to create various machine models. It has also generated numerous job opportunities indirectly. The company has often found a creative solution to the challenges it has grappled with over the years. Some include the availability of raw materials necessary to make its machines. Other challenges are optimizing its marketing strategy to find new customers to increase its reach. However, one of its major hurdles has been the US-imposed sanctions, which have hindered international money transfers, impacting global exports. Speaking of bread making, Iran is a nation of bread eaters. I'm one of them. In fact, official figures show Iranians consume some 160 kilograms of bread per capita. We better keep exercising. That's the highest in the world after Turkey. Many Iranian foods are meant to be eaten with bread on the side. So, Iran produces massive amounts of bread daily to supply this domestic demand. Based on figures from Iran's Bread Association, industrial-scale bread making holds 20% of the market and is mainly handled by machines. However, locally known as naan, traditional bread has more demand and is usually baked in tailored ovens. Around 80% of flour distributed nationwide used to be government-subsidized until this year. Meaning the government was providing part of the costs for flour to be sold at lower prices in the market. One of the reasons for removing subsidies is said to prevent people from smuggling wheat and flour out of the country. On another note, flour is also used in many other foods, which the country also exports. For example, biscuits, confections, and so forth are made in large quantities with a production capacity of around 2.5 million tons annually. That is going off of figures from the National Biscuit, Confectionery, and Chocolate Producers Association. In 2019, exports stood at $800 million, and in 2020, this figure dropped to around $450 million. Industry participants say this decline was mainly due to the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. Recent figures have not been published yet. The food and beverage industry is probably the most important part of the country's economy, accounting for over 20% of Iran's non-oil revenues. That's according to the National Chamber of Commerce.
Nearly all food products produced in Iran are made from raw materials from domestic agricultural cultivation. That is why Iran has a very robust agricultural industry. However, agriculture is not admitted to farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Products in this sector are considered strategic as they can be processed into other items, garnering more profits.
Figures from the Ministry of Agriculture show the country has over 18 million hectares of arable land. That's land that can be farmed. Last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced on farmlands. The agro industry is worth billions. Data from the National Customs Administration show the value of agricultural exports rose by 8% last year. Figures show Iran exported roughly 7 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $5 billion in the same period. Industry analysts say last year's exports declined compared to 2020, when the value was around $6 billion. They say there are several reasons for this. One is a government ban on exports of certain agricultural products, such as potatoes and aubergine, to supply domestic demands. This year, however, the ban was lifted. Another reason for the decline in exports is said to be reduced production. This was because of the coronavirus pandemic and less than average annual rainfall, coupled with outdated farming practices. All things considered, this sector has a promising future, particularly with the development of new technology used for cultivation, harvest, and processing. Health is a crucial social and economic asset. It is seen as a cornerstone for human development and the expansion of any economy. It is also considered a fundamental human right. The medical device industry is a sector with the sole purpose of improving the quality of life of its customers. Moreover, it's a source of medical innovation with heavy regulations. As a result, a lot happens behind the scenes before medical devices are released into the market.
We will venture through Iran's medical sector while shining the spotlight on medical device production. We wanted to understand how this sector has grown over the years and uncover who the major players are in this field. Plus, we will look at this sector's contribution to society and the economy.
The capital city, Tehran, has been buzzing with multiple industry exhibits in recent weeks. One of the most anticipated exhibits is the Medical Laboratory Device Show, which drew a lot of participants this year. We visited the expo to see how this market is faring and check out some of the latest developments. We caught up with several companies holding pavilions at the exhibit. Virajin was one of them. It specializes in making machines and equipment used in labs for research and diagnosis. Many holding companies were also present at the show, along with their subsidiaries, who presented their products. But that's not all. The exhibit also provides a platform for getting to know what types of services these holding companies offer.
I should say that we are a holding company, including four different companies. The holding company name is Vista Padina, and the subsidiaries companies are Tubanegin, which is active in fields of molecular biology and life sciences for more than 25 years. And Arya Tashkis Pars, which is active in fields of the tubes for the blood collection from very well-known companies for more than 20 years. And they are one of the main suppliers of the tubes for the laboratories to collect the bloods for the tests. One of our companies is just for engineering and giving backups after sales service and backup for the instruments. And the other company is Sima Polymer, which they have the production line for the plastic wares of the for the laboratories in different applications.
Thousands and thousands of products were on display here, which are mainly used in medical laboratories. Some companies displayed consumable items used in labs like swabs or thinning liquids. Others produced diagnostic kits. It might be interesting to know that medical diagnostic kits used to be previously imported. However, now with the efforts of research-based firms, many of these items have been indigenized. We spoke with a company that not only has saved the country millions on imports, but also supports various knowledge-based startups.
Exhibits like this one are bustling with people. It's a place where downstream and upstream companies in the medical lab sector can gather and showcase their latest. It also is an excellent place for potential investors to scout out lucrative investment opportunities and check out the local competition. So scores of companies participated in this exhibit this year.
Among these companies were knowledge-based manufacturers, startups, raw material suppliers, and much more. Visitors are given a chance to evaluate and discover the latest innovative products and solutions in the lab sector across all ranges. The exhibit has been put on hold since 2019 due to the coronavirus outbreak. Now it is in full swing again. Medical Laboratory Device Exhibit took place in Iran Mall. It is one of the biggest shopping centers in Iran that also offers an expansive space for trade shows. The coronavirus outbreak is subsiding nationwide due to the extensive vaccination campaign. And now, many businesses are enjoying in-person interactions through this exhibition once again. The goal of the Medical Lab Device Show is to further develop services and products used in clinical labs. It's a place where domestic and foreign participants can interact and strengthen networks. It also gathers medical industry participants, such as doctors and hospital owners, among many others in the healthcare trade. In addition, the Expo is a platform where industry decision makers visit and where scores of business deals are closed. The exhibition was coupled with a medical lab science and device conference. It was the 13th round of the international conference that was jointly held by the Medical Council and the Association of Clinical Laboratory Doctors. This was a significant event in the field of lab sciences aiming to improve lab services and technology. Some 2,700 participants from various fields of lab sciences joined the event, either virtually or in person. The five-day conference included 25 specialized seminar panel meetings with international guest speakers among Iranian experts in the field. The purpose of the conference is to exchange scientific knowledge and bridge a dialogue between lab sciences and clinical disciplines. It was also a platform to check out the latest global tech that are being used to improve lab services. Many hot topics were discussed during the conference, such as lessons learned from the coronavirus outbreak. Other discussions revolved around the future of medical diagnostic labs and the technology that will shape them. Industry practitioners say medical lab sciences is one of the most overlooked sectors in the industry, yet it plays a crucial role in the medical sector. Some 70% of all diseases in society are diagnosed by the laboratory community. All disciplines of laboratory sciences, inducing lab specialists, pathologists, and clinicians were at the forefront of the battle with the coronavirus. These specialists worked tirelessly around the clock to create diagnostic kits